21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
The road is long, and there are mountains in our way, but we climb a step every day. Love lifts us up where we belong.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and our executive producer and research assistant, Laura Cordner. Our engineer is Kristen Hagerick. Our guest is Dr. Jory Porter, professor of Indigenous History at Hall University, United Kingdom, Land and Spirit in Native America. Prager Publishers, available from the link on the front page of 21stcenturyradio.com. Joy, how did the sexual repression and misogyny of the Europeans give excuse for the extermination of semi-naked Native Americans?
Well, I don't know if I really, I'm not sure I entirely agree with the question, but there, you know, there is a definite link there. You've got, right from before discovery and after, a lot of fantasizing about what the New World might be like. And then when Columbus writes his letters in 1493, he puts quite an inordinate amount of stress on how naked and sexually available indigenous women were. And, you know, there's lots of stories from men having penises so large they just throw them over their shoulder. I don't know, maybe that's normal in Baltimore, but it's not happening here in Hull, in the UK. And, you know, stories of Columbus says that when Native women have the opportunity of copulating with Christians, they're very keen on it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously the opportunity of copulating with a Christian is always fun, but it's the way he puts it. It's almost like an advertisement saying, come to America, yeah. It's sexually free, mm-hmm. in a way that Europe wasn't. If you look at the images of Europe at this time, they're literally wearing lots of clothes, literally very buttoned up. It's an established culture with a very stratified hierarchies and very stratified notions about what was sexually permissible and what wasn't. And I think this notion of America as a promiscuous horde is one of the early ethnographic phrases. This idea that America was sexually available to European males, which of course you can link to the idea of virgin land and the rape of the land and so on. It definitely bears scrutiny.
Yeah, especially the rape of the land and the rape of the indigenous peoples.
Which did happen, yeah.
Indeed. Oh, yes, indeed. Well, can we connect this European misogyny to the native concept of Mother Earth and the resulting clash between the two cultures?
The Mother Earth idea has taken a bit of a beating in the last 15 years. In fact, the whole idea that indigenous people have got anything to contribute to environmental thinking has taken a bit of a beating, bizarrely. But the whole idea of Mother Earth has been attacked, and people have said that actually the Mother Earth concept is a Judeo-Christian, European idea, and that it's not native. Most native people will tell you that's funny if it wasn't so sad, because of course there's this very long traceable connection between a feminine sense of nature as regenerative. And I think those arguments are redundant, really. They miss the big picture point, which is that most native traditions are in a much more balanced talk and speak about a more balanced relationship to land, to place, to stone, to rock, to animals, than the Judeo-Christian tradition has ever allowed for. Mm-hmm. And I think the idea of Mother Earth is not a bad one. I mean, people, the leader of that large march in Brazil against the destruction of that major reserve, it was a 1,000-person march, he spoke of Mother Earth. I think it's a normal indigenous trope. I think the fact that it's been attacked speaks more to certain vested interests than it does to anything meaningful advancing world knowledge and world thinking. Yeah, does that answer your question?
Oh, yes, it does. I wish I had more time to spend on all of these, but I'll keep my mouth closed so we can get to the other questions. Tell us about the environmental racism as it pertains to Native Americans, and in particular to nuclear waste and Superfund sites. Friends out there, you got to sit up and listen. Wake up, because this is important.
Yeah, I think too few Americans, too few people globally know about the southwest of the United States as one of the largest peacetime militarized zones on the planet. And also one of the ways that that southwestern region has coped with its nuclear activity since the late 40s has been to dump its waste. And disproportionately, the people who've been given the task of living alongside or dealing with this waste or digging it out of the ground in terms of uranium with the Navajo, it's been Native American people. They're the people living with this stuff. And the latter half of the book looks into why this is the case, why Indian land has been deemed suitable to be a what they call a national sacrifice area. That's an idea that's put forward in 1973 by the National Academy of Sciences, who did a report on the Southwest and concluded that some areas, it was okay to use them for national priorities such as energy, irrespective of the permanent environmental damage that such exploitation would cause. So basically, sacrificing Indians, Indian people, Indian land, Indian water sources, Indian resources and sustenance. This is an articulation of a decision by the United States, which many social justice activists have spoken up about. There's a wonderful book, actually, by a writer who's no longer in the academy, I don't think, Valerie Kulitz, and she's written a book called The Tainted Desert, and she's the daughter of a nuclear scientist and grew up in the Southwest, and she's written this wonderful book, which has its flaws, but is also a good book, explaining how this all came about, not so much with an indigenous slant, but she's looking at the whole nuclear Southwest issue and what it means that that part of the world and indigenous people there are having to deal with this nuclear legacy, which, of course, is potentially limitless. You know, this is not a pollution that's going to go away anytime
no, it's
soon.
Not. No. But you say our environmental movement, even today, suffers from the fatal anthropocentrism stemming from the Bible, giving man dominion over the earth. Can this be changed?
And I think this idea of sacrifice, I go into this in the book as well, this idea of national sacrifice areas and what it means to designate Native peoples as the people making the sacrifice.
Yeah.
I connect this to Judeo-Christian thinking, you know, which of course has the supreme sacrificer, Christ, at the center, and how really this is a perversion of true Christian sacrifice.
That's for sure.
Because sacrifice is not something you can elect that others do involuntarily. Sacrifice should be something that's a spiritual choice because of its transformative power. You know, I think within the proper reading of the Christian tradition, that's how it should be. Mm-hmm. It should be understood. And I, you know, obviously it's not fair. But the burden of the nuclear movement, and by the way, President Obama seems to be committed to a nuclear renaissance as the future energy solution for the United States. I don't think it's fair that Native people are carrying that burden and look likely to carry a disproportionate level of it into the future.
I obviously agree with you. There are several things in the area of the environment that President Obama was lacking in. But could you tell this is one of the things that was hard for me to read, but tell us about the, I hope I pronounce this correctly, Amchicta nuclear tests in the late 60s and their impact on Native Americans.
Yes, this is famous because it's the largest underground test ever conducted by the United States. It was 400 times the power of the Hiroshima bomb, and the island still being monitored for leakage of radioactive materials, not surprisingly. But it's also famous because the whole Greenpeace movement arose because of Antigua. Mm-hmm. So it spawned out of what was probably quite a negative thing. It spawned the Greenpeace movement, which I think most of us agree is probably a good thing. In saying that, you know, I don't want listeners to be thinking that Native Americans are necessarily against nuclear power, and the book does discuss this, that there are a lot of thinking, you know, because one of the good things about a lot of Native American thought, I think, is it doesn't think in binary terms, black and white.
That's right.
A lot of Native traditions see the good in evil and the evil in good, which I think is a wonderful intellectual advance.
Mm-hmm. It is.
On binary thought. And, of course, a lot of Christian thinking can be interpreted in a very binary way, good and evil, Satan and Christ, you know, this on-off switch. So a lot of Native, certain Native thinkers see nuclear as an energy, just one more energy that has to be lived with and managed, and there needs to be a relationship with it, so it's not as simple. And who am I to say that necessarily this genie can ever be put back in the box? In fact, I agree with the thinking that really America should probably be taking more waste from around the world, certainly from a strategic safety point of view, because the more waste and nuclear material that is floating around in wrong hands, the more dangerous it is for world security. So I'm not saying there are any easy answers here, but by any means, this is big picture stuff.
Well, this big picture stuff here is you gave us a terrific lesson on the Superfund, and not surprisingly, how these pollution sites disproportionately affect Native Americans. What happened?
Well, I think that the big answer is that Native peoples have not been able to put their case forward sufficiently and not been able to be heard. One of the nice things about this book is the number of scientists who communicated with me to help me write it, one of whom looked at his whole thing is looking at risk and how risk is communicated and, you know, how badly scientists communicate risk. And this has led to a number of quite severe conflicts between Native peoples and nuclear scientists and others. I go into quite a lot of history of nuclearism in the United States. I think the big answer is the EPA has been underfunded over successive decades, and that Native peoples simply haven't been listened to. There have been larger forces. I mean, I talk, for example, about the Goshute Nation, who are surrounded by some of the most evil polluters. Evil in terms of dangerous pollution. I mean, hideous gases tested near their reservation and so on. And famously, the Goshute wanted to invite waste storage onto their reservation because largely there was no other option or limited options. They didn't in the end, but you can see where if you're surrounded by pollution, you can't really feasibly grow tomatoes, you know, it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was not up to date on, I didn't realize that the tax law in 1995, the $3.8 billion fund held at its peak was finally used up in 2003. Mm-hmm. And that it appears that the Americans now are footing the bill for the pollution, that is, the citizens of America now are. I always thought that it was the job of those who polluted to fix it up. But I guess I'm still living back in 1926 or something here. But
that was always an aspiration more than than a reality, I suppose. You know, the more you're talking, it reminds me that we've been living beyond our means. You know, we have massive sovereign debt in the United States and in a lot of countries in Europe. And we're also living environmentally beyond our means.
Yeah.
You know, we have not been paying for the pollution that we have been creating, full stop. We've been storing it up as a problem for the future, the same way we've been storing up debt for the future.
Yeah.
And I think, as with both things, there's an exponential curve which gets damned steep towards the end.
Well,
I think with nuclear, that the steepness of that curve could have quite horrific repercussions.
I'm afraid so. But right now, we have other things getting in our way, and that's another break here on 21st Century Radio. Our guest, of course, is Dr. Joy Porter, professor of Indigenous History at Hall University in the United Kingdom, and Land and Spirit in Native America, Prager Publishers. It's available from the link on the front page of 21stcenturyradio.com.
With Band of the Gypsies and the Jimi Hendrix Experience, you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA, and he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio with our guest, Dr. Joy Porter, professor of Indigenous History at Hall University in the United Kingdom, Land and Spirit in Native America, Prager Publishers. We hope this book sells about 5 million copies. It deserves to. Maybe we can educate some folks in this country. It's available from the link on the front page of 21st Century Radio. Dr. Porter, why is it important to take heed of the experience of Native Americans in regards to nuclear waste?
I mean, as I've said, nuclear power is unlikely to go away. And, you know, the Obama administration is fairly committed to both storage and a renaissance in nuclear power production. I also make the point in this book that a blanket anti-nuclearism is just not adequate. We can't put this genie back in the box. And I do think that Native people have a unique understanding of what it means to live with nuclear waste and nuclear storage and nuclear production. And I think we could do well to listen to their experience. But, you know, as you said during the break, Bob, it is remarkable the places that we choose to put nuclear storage. You look at Yucca Mountain, for example, and this is all in the area around Las Vegas and Nevada. You've got to wonder why deserts are chosen, because deserts traditionally sit on large aquifers. The main aquifer for that region is on the mountain where they plan to store significant amounts of nuclear waste. You've really got to ask yourself, how is risk assessed? And I think it's a fascinating topic. And certainly Indigenous voices are not listened to at all when it comes to these choices and decisions. I think we've all got to live with nuclear waste and nuclear production to some greater or lesser extent. And I think the days of just having a top-down approach to this really need to come to an end.
Well, certainly we agree with that. You know, when we were talking a little bit, I keep thinking of Joplin, Missouri, in the United States, where we have some wonderful nuclear power a plant, along with a great fault. It is sitting on a fault and an aquifer. This is almost—it's nearing the center of this country.
Yeah.
If that has an accident, that is in Joplin, Missouri, it will. The center of our country is going to be one big hole. It's unforgivable, as far as I'm concerned, that this kind of stuff is done. In your book, you note that in 2003, the EPA reported that there were 602 hazardous waste sites on or impacting on Indian country, and 55 national priority list are affecting 50 tribes. So the Native Americans have been living with this for a long time. And
now, is that a function of the fact that they're the people least able to say not in my backyard forcefully enough that it's listened to in Washington? Or is that a symptom of their history, that they are in places that are deemed by scientists to be good places to stick nuclear waste? because they were also deemed to be good places to stick Indians in the past.
That's right.
Well, that's an interesting question.
Well, it seems reasonable to, when you look at that assessment, it seems reasonable that they're certainly not looking on the Native Americans with any great favor. As you point out, one of the fundamental points in your books is that the environmental crisis is part of a spiritual crisis, to use the words of Al Gore. And you then talk about the science and politics are unlikely to be enough to prompt necessary changes. And that was attempted in 2007, I believe. And then the particular company went bankrupt. And so therefore they cannot be sued. There's nowhere to go in that particular issue. I've forgotten which state that might be in right now. But it just seems that sometimes there is a method of delay that corporate America knows how to use so that you really can't get to making these changes in a timely fashion that could make a difference.
Yes, I mean, another recent topic is this phenomenon of carbon trading and this thing called RED. It's an acronym, which really means carbon trading, you know, where you can pollute in exchange for planting some trees somewhere else or doing something that trades your carbon footprint. And a lot of indigenous people are vastly against this as a smokescreen, a greenwash. It simply allows pollution to be transported from one place to another, from the rich to the poor. I do think and agree with Al Gore that the environmental crisis is in part a spiritual crisis. And I think scientists themselves have come to this conclusion. They're saying that, you know, we've tried saying how urgent this and pressing this problem is. And we've done all the usual methods. We've done rational analysis. We've used clear words. We've used, you know, computer modeling. We've put data systems in place. We've tried to explain this to people. But I think while it remains in the corral of science, and while these issues don't get discussed meaningfully by historians and by cultural studies people and by people who write and think more broadly, then I think it overcoming the inertia required is not gonna happen. I mean, there are lots of other strategies that are talked about. Various forms of geoengineering have been suggested as the way to solve our environmental problems. But if you think back to the last major piece of geoengineering which was done, which was the Haber process where we learned how to fix nitrogen,
mm-hmm.
Well, the result of that was more food production by, I think it was 250 times more food production than had been done before because we could fix nitrogen and boost artificially how much plants could produce. That was great, but it caused the kind of overpopulation problem that we're now dealing with globally, which is, again, something one's not really encouraged to think about or write about or study.
Mm-hmm.
But it is the great squat toad in terms of problems facing us all in the future. We are a crowded planet, getting increasingly crowded. And the repercussions of that, the problems of who gets what, I mean, there will come a point where the 1%, or more particularly the 0.01%, will not be able to protect themselves from these kinds of problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they won't. I need to go back to Yosemite because it was one of my favorite parks, still is in some ways. Could you please explain the irony in what places like Yosemite were so appealing to European naturalists because they weren't wild at all, really. The indigenous peoples had carefully kept them that way for generations with controlled burning and other means. Boy, I was so thrilled to learn this. This is another thing, another hole in my education. Could you discuss this, please?
I think, if you're interested in that, there's two scholars called Turek and Teller, who I think are the world's ranking experts on the formation of wilderness parks. Not many people know that,
yeah.
But they are. And they did this wonderful thing where they went from park to park and looked in detail at how these parks came to be. And they look at Yosemite, but maybe not in the same detail that I do. And Yosemite is, I think, interesting because it's emblematic. It's so ridiculously beautiful and so much like the movie version of what a beautiful wilderness should look like. If you look into its history, it was quite heavily populated. About 12 years before it was discovered, you know, there was, mm-hmm. there was fairly large communities there. And these people were removed. You know, previous things like the gold rush had done a good job at decimating populations and colonization itself and various wars. But they were actively removed in order to make way for wilderness. And of course, when you go to Yosemite now, you don't really get a sense that the valley itself had a name, that there was a community there. I find very difficult to pronounce, but it sounds like Ahwahnee.
That sounds
good
enough.
I can't really say it. And, you know, there were famous, relatively famous individuals living there who are on record saying things like, why are you naming this place that already has a name?
Mm-hmm.
And this is this process of creating wilderness and just removing mankind, indigenous mankind from it, and saying, no, this is pure, this is unsullied, this is designated space. But of course, the reason it looked so much like a European park with trickling water and meandering streams and lovely open vistas was because it was burned in order to be like that. But also another big reason was because it's a glacial landscape. You know, but it's not surprising when you think about it that there would be indigenous people living there. It is a wonderful place. It's easily defensible and it teems with produce that you can live on. So the real question is why we've never questioned that it was empty in the first place. Of course it wasn't. And the real question is why did that never occur to us? Why have we been so wedded to the idea that there are certain places on Earth that have no human history? There are very few places like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but we have this desire to think about wilderness as somehow existing without the footprint of mankind. And I think that desire, that romantic notion, is actually very dangerous, and it links directly to our myopia about pollution and about environmental misuse and decay.
Mm-hmm. As you note, on Yosemite, no other park has a worse record when it comes to the treatment of Native peoples than Yosemite. Brutal military conquest of the land. A park created with no regard, just as you just mentioned, for the past or present Native claims, and ignoring of the petition for redress of grievances by Congress, eviction of remnant villages, etc. Boy, you know, there was a series on all the parks on National Public Television. I'm trying to think of the very famous guy that put it together. Ken Burns, yes.
Right, that did the Civil War movies?
Yes, yes. Did you see it?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay, because I would have loved your opinion of it.
Does it mention indigenous people?
Not enough, no, and certainly not what you taught me, which is, you know, that Yosemite's level floor, gentle pools, broad meadows, deep with grass, that the Native Americans had a great deal to do with that.
Of course.
I know, but that's, of course, not what history tells us, that we found it like that. Nobody.
Yeah.
Nobody.
Look, there it was, and it was completely empty, really.
Yeah, that's right.
And no one had named it, so we named it.
Yeah, the arrogance is a bit, it is a deliberate ignoring, that is, the native peoples that lived there. I think it was deliberate.
But it does tie to a notion of wilderness, and I think wilderness is actually quite a dangerous concept.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that land exists, it's outside of man's historical relationship. It's, usually dangerous when someone paints that picture.
Well, if you think that's dangerous, where do we get into the nobility next segment here? This is 21st Century Radio, and our guest is Dr. Joy Porter, and I wish we had 22 hours. I know she doesn't have the time, we don't have it, but still, this is an important work, friends. This is the kind of book that no college, no university should be without. Even in high school, they can read and understand this, especially now that people are beginning to understand the serious problems we're having with climate change. We'll be back with Dr. Joy Porter. And, of course, this book is Land and Spirit in Native America, Prager Publishers. And it's you can find a link on the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com. Hey, I'll tell you what. If you purchase a copy of this book and you can prove it, you can have any book that I or Zoe have ever, well, that we've published. Not we haven't published them, but the other publishers have. That's how important this work is. We'll be back in just all that many seconds.
This is Bill McKibben, author and environmental activist. You're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for doing all you can to try to change the energy future of this country.
I learned a safety rule.
Our guest is Dr. Joy Porter, and she is the professor of Indigenous History at Hull University in the United Kingdom, Land and Spirit in Native America, Prager Publishers, available from the link on the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com. And one of our fascinating new perspectives I learned from your book is how the Native American lifestyle actually resembled that of the nobility in Europe. These Indians, in quote, living above their station caused disgust among early explorers. Can you please elaborate on this?
Yeah, there's quite a few records of this. There's a couple of interesting phrases, such as the need to reduce Indians to civility,
yes.
To reduce them to their proper station. And, you know, you've heard the phrase noble savage.
Oh, yes.
Well, that has multiple meanings and implications. But the thing about Indians was they tended to behave rather like the way European nobility did, living nomadically, moving seasonally, spending their time hunting and resting, and not straining themselves to meet the needs of settled farming. So this looked rather a lot like how the nobility were spending their time. So rather a lot of accounts saying that these people are living above their station. They're living a very healthful, unstressed life, and seems to be quite happy doing it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the evidence for this is how many people turn Indian, how many people actually defect to Indian communities and marry into Indian kinship networks.
Mm-hmm.
Indian life seems to be a much more positive way of living. I'm not the only person who says this or something like it. There's a wonderful writer called Hugh Brody who wrote a wonderful book called Maps and Dreams, and he talks about the hunter-gatherer lifestyle as being one of the most restful and health-inducing ways of living. So you can kind of understand the jealousy here. And of course, it depends on how many resources you've got, did appear to a number of Europeans like Indians were having far too good a time.
I loved your chapter about art, but not when I learned that art was a part of a wider onslaught that sought to kill Indian ways. How did that come about?
Probably the most interesting thing about art, Indian art, is how it's become a commodity, especially as you get into the 20th century, and how it's always been a good barometer, a good reflector of how America has perceived and related to Native peoples. Who gets to produce Native art and who doesn't? I think there's always a conceptual hurdle to get over. because the idea of art is not necessarily one that has an equivalent in most Native communities. This idea of art, again, is something that's separate from everyday life, that's, again, separate from the spiritual. That doesn't really translate. And, of course, in the Western tradition, art is a highly individualized activity. You know, you sign your painting. Rather, a lot of art historically and prehistorically produced by indigenous communities has been about and mediated through larger groups.
Mm-hmm.
It's not individualized, and it's not for individuals, and it's not about reflecting necessarily. Of course, there is a long tradition also of people signing their work, and that's accelerated in the 20th century. But when you have art operating within a communal system, it's in a totally different context than how European art is perceived and perpetuated.
Well, why do Indian artists have to prove they are Indian when black artists or white artists don't have to prove that they're black or white?
I think this is as the British say, a bloody good question. I think it connects to this notion of Indian art being consumable, saleable, and precious because it represents something in antithesis to civilization, in antithesis to community. And for that reason, it can be sold.
Mm-hmm.
And so the notion of who can and who can't produce it is I think it's all really related to this idea of I have another chapter on this on demographics, and I make the big case that if Indian artists or Indians per se keep accepting the colonial notion that they have to define themselves strictly, then by definition, they will define themselves out of existence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're constantly policing who is and isn't an Indian, eventually the numbers will get smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
Especially when historically that defining process was done not by Indians themselves, but by external forces.
Like a government force?
Yes, the tribal rules, for example, which you know, there's many reasons why Indians wouldn't want to be on the 1887 tribal rules. Because they may be liable for tax, they may be forcibly repositioned somewhere else in the country. You become of notice to government bodies, and which of course Native people over time have learned to be wary of. So there are real problems with relying on tribal rules or any government-sponsored way of defining identity. I think the whole issue of identity is an enormous one. And I think many artists have spoken against this notion that they have to define themselves in order to practice. And I have every respect for those who simply ignore the whole thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Of course, it's very difficult to be an artist, full stop, and it's very difficult to do so without support from your community, whether it's federal groups or community groups, and if the wider forces are demanding that you identify yourself,
mm-hmm.
then I can understand why people do it.
Yeah, I couldn't too. Well, you use your last chapter to analyze a recent best-selling book and Oscar-nominated film called Into the Wild, comparing it to the earliest conceptions of wild and wilderness. What did you find objectionable about this book and the film in that regard?
I think it's a wonderful film if you turn your brain off. You know, it's kind of it's like wilderness pornography. You know, there's lots of beautiful shots of sunsets and deer drinking water in streams and so on. You know, if you don't think and you don't care about the environmental politics it's putting forward, then it's a great movie and it's got attractive people in it. The young Kirsten Stewart's in it and Emile Hirst, I think his name is, you know, and there's a lovely soundtrack by Eddie Vedder of Pearl Jam, who's, no wonder he was uncomfortable doing this film. But I think it more or less brings the book up to date because everything that's wrong about wilderness thinking that's led to national sacrifice areas, that's led to the kind of inertia we have and wrong thinking and ahistorical thinking about wilderness land and spirituality in American soil is summed up in that movie. Mm. It's the story of a young boy who's just coming out of adolescence, who rejects his parents, who probably, like most parents, made mistakes, and he goes into the wild. He ends up in Alaska, after a long story, and basically starves to death because he's tried to test himself against a completely bogus notion of what nature and the environment is. He goes on a sort of vision quest, but without any community context. He doesn't take GPS. He doesn't ask any of the indigenous people of Alaska about how you can survive there, what plants you can eat, and whether you should be there at all. He shouldn't have been. It was part of the big melt when it's very dangerous to be there at all. And he goes off into a notion of the wilderness that's extremely dangerous and for which he has no balanced respect. And I think it connects directly to all this ahistorical thinking. And there's a lovely contribution in the book from an Alaskan scholar who's worked with the Denali National Park and so on, and with indigenous people, agreeing with me basically that this book is the last thing we should be teaching young people. That the John Krakauer, John McCandless, who's the guy who ends up dead, that vision of wilderness is not the one we should be emulating. You know, we shouldn't be falling for that romanticness. And it saddens me that left-wing people like Eddie Vedder and Sean Penn should be perpetuating this bogus notion of the American individual going out and conquering the wild.
Oh.
You know, it's so negative and so not what we need right now. We need to be much more thinking about man productively and reciprocally relating to nature and to land and to communities. We need to be thinking on a community rather than an individual level about the environment and about place and about nature.
Well, whenever we go on to any type of journey, be it in the physical world, a spiritual journey or whatever, one needs to prepare themselves. And as a matter of fact, that's one of the reasons why you have other teachers. It seems kind of arrogant to go try to do it yourself. And
well, I suppose, you know, when it comes to John Krakauer's book or the movie Into the Wild, these are commercial exercises. I mean, John Krakauer, this is how he makes his primary living. He's got to make a saleable product.
That's right, yeah.
It's not like my book where I'm paid to be a professor and so I can write what I figure is the truth. And I'm not saying John Krakauer was lying, but he's definitely writing a book that's about sales and commercially orientated, and the stuff that sells is usually not always the stuff that's most true. What really bothers me is that this is being fed to young people. The book was marketed to young people, environmentally minded young people, and so was the film. And even sadder still, someone died trying to copy young McCandless's journey and young McCandless's thinking, which is even sadder, you know, that a misguided, I think mentally ill, young lad's idea of what the wilderness is put forward as being positive. And I think that the individual nature of it, the way that he discards and avoids all community, which is maybe a symptom of how messed up modern life is, that is the worst thing. He has no elder. He has no guide. And he does this as an individual. Mm-hmm. He sees nature as something you test your strength against, and you test the self.
Mm-hmm.
Krakauer, the guy who wrote the book of his life, makes a hideous analogy and says that he goes into the wild in the same way that one approaches the secret of a woman or something equally nauseating. And I think that book by Krakauer and the movie sums up pretty much everything my book is against.
Yes, it does.
And it's sad and unfortunate that's what's on offer to our young people. Glamorized notions that are ahistorical, untrue, that take indigenous people out of the landscape, and that reinforce a negative story and a negative relationship to land. And again, landscapes all about deer drinking water and sunlight, and it's nothing to do with the reality of reciprocal relationships with land.
Well, Joy, that's the reason why your work is so important, because your research is so solid. It comes from so many sources. You do not just tell one side of the story. You give multiple views of that. And that is a great joy in regards to, and that's what I like about good academic writing as well, because you
I would love to just mention John Fadden, who's an Indian friend of both of ours, and who did the painting, the paintings that are that illustrate the book. I mean, John's someone with a beautiful understanding of nature, and I always learn from him every time I see him, you know. But I think the academic in me will always put the other side of the story as much as I possibly can, and I always trust people who are prepared to do that.
And John is used to explaining himself to those people who would doubt. And that is the kind of thing one would expect of an individual whose soul is really involved in the spiritual, great spiritual traditions of indigenous people. Joy, this has been all too short. I want to thank you for opening my eyes and my heart to these particular areas.
It's always a complete inspiration and a real pleasure to talk to you. And you know, long may you continue. That's all I can say.
Well, thank you very much.
Keep doing the voodoo that you do, that's what I think.
We'll do the best we can. Thanks for joining us, dear, and I look forward to being with you again.
These are crazy days, but they make me shine. Time keeps rolling.
Talk around the clock and breaking news now on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio, I'm Bill Fitka. Deadly aim.